and welcome to this latest Lowy Institute live event. This is part of what we are calling the Long Distance Lowy Institute, in which we communicate our content and analysis online while we are unable to do so in person. A very warm welcome to everyone joining us from Australia and to those dialing in from overseas, and a warm welcome also to our Lowy Institute corporate members and supporters. My name is Dr. Roger Shanahan. I'm a research fellow here at the West Asia program at the Lowy Institute. Now, it's certainly an exciting time to be an Emirati these days. This country is quickly racking up an impressive list of technological firsts. Last month, the UAE launched the Arab world's first interplanetary mission when a Mars orbiter called Amal, or Hope, took off from a launch site in Japan, and it's expected to arrive at Mars in February next year. And this month, the first nuclear power station in the Arab world went online in Abu Dhabi. But the country is also an increasingly active political actor in the region. Joining me today to discuss the UAE's view of and its role in the region is the UAE's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Dr. Anwar Gargash. Dr. Gargash is a member of the Federal Cabinet of the United Arab Emirates, and he has served as the Minister of State for Foreign Affairs since 2008. Between 2006 and 2016, Dr. Gargash was the Minister of State for the Federal National Council Affairs. In addition to his ministerial portfolios, Dr. Gargash was Chairman of the National Elections Committee, overseeing the UAE's first elections, which took place in 2006, and the subsequent elections in 2011 and 2015. He was also a board member of the Dubai Chamber of Commerce and Industry from 1997 to 2006. But he has an even more impressive academic record, having received his PhD from King's College, Cambridge, and he holds bachelor's and master's degrees in political science from George Washington University. Before I go to our guests, some quick housekeeping. At the bottom of your screens, you'll see a Q&A button, where you can submit questions to the panellists. We'll put as many of your questions as possible to Dr. Gargash later in the discussion. So please include the name of your organisation or any affiliation when you send through your question. But first, of course, I have some, indeed many questions for our panellists. So first of all, I'd like to welcome you to the Lowy Institute online, Dr. Gargash, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be here to speak to this very esteemed think tank and to those who are watching us.
Now, firstly, I'd like to have us look at Emirati-Australian relations. And on the surface, they appear to be very good. The UAE has long hosted our deployed air elements and deployed national headquarters of the Australian Defence Force assets in the Middle East. And while our trade relationship for a long time had centered on vehicles, oil and foodstuffs, with the end of vehicle manufacturing in Australia, it's now become more diversified. There are three Australian universities who have campuses in the UAE. There are around 300 companies and around 20,000 Australian expatriates who are based there now. We also have a bilateral agreement on the peaceful use of nuclear energy, which allows for the importation of Australian uranium at some stage in the future. But one of the limits to further expansion in our bilateral economic relationship is the inability of Australia to secure a free trade agreement with the GCC countries. Negotiations with the UAE began in 2005, but Australia was then advised that there would be a unified GCC free trade agreement, and negotiations for that started in 2007 until 2009, but they stalled after the GCC announced a review. And now, given the disagreement with Qatar since 2017, there's little resolution in sight for an Australian GCC free trade agreement. Now, Dr. Gargash, first of all, can I ask you, firstly, how the UAE views Australia as a country and its relations in the region, and particularly with the UAE, and whether you think our economic relations or our bilateral economic relations can ever reach their full potential without an FTA being signed?
Well, again, I think to start with, our relations with Australia are excellent. They are, I think, to a certain extent, a model where the relationship transcends the distance, the distance and the time zone, etc. I think we've managed to do that because of several things. We've got great links, airline links, between the UAE and Australia, and that certainly has helped sort of shrink the distance and make sure that this relationship, you know, is not somehow seen as a relationship with a very distant country. That's the way we view it. I think, again, we've got also several other aspects that are important here. I would suggest that, you know, the effort of many Australian companies also to be present in Middle Eastern markets and use the UAE as a logistical hub has also played an important role in this. There are about 300 Australian companies that are located in the UAE. I would also say that over the years, what has mostly been commercial transactional relationship is moved with, I would say, a slower pace. And I think this is where we need to work more to other aspects, to you know, to a better understanding on counterterrorism. I think Australia values highly you know, our views on how you see the region, because the UAE has been quite consistent in how it sees the region. You might agree with it, you might disagree with it, but the UAE speaks one language, and that'll be in closed doors, and it'll be also in public forums. And I think this is comforting when you build those relationships. Having said that, I would say that this is a constant debate also that we have here, which is we need to spend more time on various countries. And Australia is always one of the top of the lists. It's one of those countries where we need to put more effort, more time, more concentration. You have to realize that any country in our region can allow itself to be consumed by the problems of the region. And I think the UAE, while having to manage also the problem of its neighborhood, is always conscious and cognizant of the necessity of investing more effort and time in what I would call win-win relationships, such as Australia, where, you know, you don't really have a fundamental political issue hindering the development of that relationship. Vis-a-vis the GCC angle, I mean, I would agree with you. We took a decision a few years ago in the GCC context of doing FTAs as a group. And we thought that the, you know, collective volume makes us in a better negotiating place when, you know, when we sign these FTAs with economies that are larger than our, you know, single entity in the GCC. Unfortunately, that has also led to delays and in signing many of these FTAs. And as you know, I mean, trying to get you know, the consensus of six countries is different than a single decision by a single country. So these are also some of the issues that I would say that your description of them are quite apt. And I think that we in the UAE also feel frustrated, because among the GCC countries, I think we see ourselves as the one that is much more open to free trade and much more open towards, you know, a sort of embracing these FTAs.
Thanks very much, Dr. Gargash. Now, I'd like to perhaps focus a little bit more specifically on the UAE. And as I mentioned before, you are becoming a much more active player, not only in the region, but internationally over the last 10 to 15 years. And that includes the use of your military force. And normally, given the size constraints of the UAE, it was normally part of a broader Western or international coalition. And we sent forces to Kosovo, to Somalia under the UN, and to Afghanistan. And the former Secretary of Defense, General Jim Mattis, described your country as little Sparta in recognition of your ability to generate forces from a small country and very capable forces. Now, more recently, though, the UAE has been part of a series of interventions that have not gone well. You supplied significant air, land, and sea assets to Yemen as part of Saudi-led Operation Decisive Storm, which was ostensibly launched, and I quote, to defend the UN-recognised government of Yemen and to save the Yemeni people from Houthi aggressors. And when it was launched, it promised a swift resolution to the issue. Yet 5 years later, the UAE has now completed the withdrawal of its troops from Yemen with really little to show for those 5 years' worth of efforts. And in Libya, the UAE, along with France and Russia, have backed the forces of General Haftar against a UN-recognised government of national accord. And General Haftar's forces were decisively defeated in their attempts, their year-long attempts to capture the capital Tripoli in June this year. And now the Turkish-backed government appears to be in the ascendancy. Now, do you think that the UAE is perhaps overreaching now in terms of its military deployments, in terms of the last two significant sides that you've backed in regional conflicts?
Well, I think to start with, the UAE is, in terms of, you know, rough size, the UAE is a medium-sized country in our region, vis-a-vis its political presence, vis-a-vis a population of around 10 million people. But economically, the UAE is the third largest economy in the Middle East. Turkey is the first. Saudi Arabia is the second. The UAE is the third. It has an economy larger than Iran, and it has an economy larger than Israel. So from an economic term, the UAE is an important player in the region. Now, I think to understand our thinking here, our thinking really revolves around three things. Number one is we are living in a very changing international system, and the idea that the UAE can actually go back to what people see as a typical Gulf state rentier model is something that the international system has changed. It's a different international system, which means that you have to take some responsibility for the peace and security of the region. You know, the whole, you know, sort of certainty of a two-pole world or a U.S., you know, unipolar world, etc., is no longer there. I mean, these continue to be major players, but we also see an international system that is changing. So an important part of why we are involved in some of these issues of peace and stability is because we feel the ground shaking under us, and we feel that we have to take certain responsibilities to do with our own region security. I think that's number one. I think number two is that we also understand that our relationships with other parties that we expect to like-minded countries should be really a two-way street. And from that perspective, our forces were in Afghanistan for over 10 years because you can't expect others to help you if you're not willing really to help your friends, your larger friends, and be valuable to them as you expect that they will be valuable to you if a national emergency arises. So our understanding also is that the passive model of a Gulf state is no longer acceptable as the, you know, the sort of issues around peace and stability in the region change. You have to actually add value. You have to be seen as a burden-sharing partner. And I think from that perspective, you've seen us in NATO, in the Balkans. You've seen us in NATO in Libya. We have to remember that our current involvement in Libya is a legacy involvement because we were part of the NATO also operation. And, you know, you can't just turn these things on and turn them off, as you know. I think the third important element here is the issue of working with like-minded friends. So this is the rule for us. We don't work alone. You know, the idea of overextension that you spoke about, I think we're trying to counter it by saying, you know, we don't really have what I would say the political and military gravitas to work alone. So everywhere really that you see us playing a role, we're a member of the team, we're a constructive member, we're a member that brings, you know, some advantage and real contribution, but we never work alone. And I think this addresses some of the issues that you hear about, is the UAE overextending? And I would say, you know, the UAE is never alone in any of the theaters that you mentioned. I mean, in Libya, I would correct you, but we're really working with the French and the Egyptians, and it depends with some other European countries, depending on a certain day whether they feel that this is the issue of counterterrorism is major as we see it, or the issue of counterterrorism is secondary as they might see it on that day. Now, I have also to take issue with Yemen. I would say that Yemen is a very complicated war. And again, the issue is, was there a clear victory? I would argue that all recent wars really in the region have been very difficult and very also difficult to come and say that there was a clear victory there. I mean, I mentioned Afghanistan as an example. I mentioned Iraq as an example. You don't really, and here you have also the might of the United States behind the operations in Afghanistan with NATO, and the might of the United States with a huge coalition in Iraq. But you don't really end up with a clear victory as we sometimes, you know, mythically see wars. And I think vis-a-vis Yemen, there are things that we achieved and that there are things we did not achieve. But I think what we achieved mostly in Yemen was we denied a major geostrategic shift in Iran's favor in Yemen. I mean, again, this was supposed to be a big, big victory for Iran, where suddenly you have a pro-Iranian militia controlling all of Yemen, independent, recognized by the world, a state that Iran can actually use as another pawn on the chessboard. That has been denied. Now, having said that, this was a very complicated war. And I think we did very well also, because as you mentioned, you know, in the Arab world, we have a very professional army. This is an army that actually retires officers, that has people who are in the field, you know, sort of brigadiers and colonels and generals who are in their 40s, who have seen operation. And just to give you a number here, in a small army such as the UAE's, 20,000 of them have seen service in Afghanistan because of rotation. And this is very unusual in the Arab world, where you have an army that is actually very capable, although it's an army of a small state, but it's very capable. So did we succeed in Yemen? I think history will tell. Did we achieve some of our goals? Yes, we did. Did we fail in some of our goals? Yes, we did. But again, I think this is the way that we look at it. And again, in Yemen, I think the different thing in Yemen, all the other instances you mentioned, we always had a major superpower and Western presence there, whether it was in Libya or in Afghanistan or in the Balkans. In Yemen, this was really an Arab coalition, and this was the first time that an Arab coalition had to respond to a geostrategic threat where Iran was going to change perhaps the geostrategic balance in the region. I know that people will take issue with some of my conclusions, but these are the things I see. And as I said, we've never really seen the sort of clear victory in the region in the last 20 years. So I would say that this is more in line of what we have seen in the region rather than an aberration of what we are seeing in the region.
I'd now like to shift again to current relations between the UAE and Turkey, the region's largest economy, as you pointed out. And they say a week's a long time in politics, but 2 years is an eternity in Middle Eastern politics. And I noted that at the Asian Society, in an interview you did with former Prime Minister Rudd from Australia, you referred to Egypt and Turkey as two of the region's old states with whom you had no problems. But in July this year, you wrote in the French media that, and I quote, Erdogan has made it clear that he does not wish to be a bridge between Europe and the Arab world. Last week, the Turkish Defence Minister described the UAE as a functional country that serves others politically or militarily and is used remotely. And you, in response or semi-response, tweeted that relations are not managed by threats and there is no place for colonialist delusions in this day and age. Now, those are quite undiplomatic words from a very senior diplomat. What's gone wrong between the UAE and Turkey in the last 2 years?
I think the main issue is we have an Arab regional system that is going through a very difficult time. You know, the Arab world is already polarized, but the Arab world is in agreement over one thing, which is non-interference in its own affairs. So, you know, if you have issues and problems within the Arab world, there's a, like a red line around what is considered, you know, Arab territorial sovereignty. And I think this is a major agreement by all countries, all the way from Morocco to Oman. And I think this is an essential and fundamental part of the Arab world's regional system, weak as it is. Over the last 20 years or so, Iran has been known to encroach on the Arab world system of, of boasting that it is controlling four Arab capitals. And Iran has always been seen as the very unruly and difficult neighbor because of its aggressive policy towards the Arab world. Now, many of these important regional players see a soft belly to their south, which is really the Arab world. The Turks, too, for a long time, and this is when you refer also to those remarks, the Turks for a long time have acted more as a Westphalian state, conscious of borders, conscious of non-interference in their affairs. And, you know, the the Ataturkist dictum really of Turkey was peace at home and peace in the world. So clearly this was the sort of Turkish foreign policy for decades and decades. I think with the AKP being bolder and realizing that there are several opportunities, geostrategic opportunities, that policy has changed. So as a result, Turkey was shut out of Europe, and as a result, Turkey started to encroach more on the Arab world. And this is a policy that has developed slowly, but has been speeded up for different reasons. I think there are several things happening here. On the one hand, it's very ideological because the AKP is very much an ideological party. And the AKP is seeing that it might have a role in Turkey leading the Islamic world. As Iran is leading the Shia world, Turkey can lead the Islamic world. So this is, in one instance, very much ideologically. I think number two, from our view also, is geostrategic. Turkey is also positioning itself to be a key in two or three of the issues of our times in the region. And the Syrian issue is one particular issue, and now Libya is emerging as another particular issue. It will strengthen Turkey also geostrategically in the Eastern Mediterranean, where Turkey does not want to be left out of all these gas finds that are promising in the Eastern Mediterranean. Number three is clearly there is an Islamist, several groups. The most important is the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, you've really had the rise of political Islam since 1979. And I think right now we're seeing political Islam on the wane, because clearly for 30 years, political Islam has not been able to give the region what I would call a progressive and successful platform to looking towards the future. And people are realizing that. But the AKP is part of that and parcel of that group, and as a result is trying to lead. It is interesting that both Iran and Turkey, in my opinion, they can see that there are shifts in the international system. And they can see that a large regional country can actually gain some extra space in the international system. And Turkey and Iran both see themselves as important regional players, and they are. But clearly, they cannot exert influence to the north, where the old Soviet republics are there, because this will be a conflict with Russia about political influence and so on and so forth. So clearly, the most attractive region, with all its troubles, all its problems, is the southern belly. And that is really the Arab world. And this is what we've really seen. So really, our counter argument to the Turks and Iranians is, you are historical neighbors of the Arab world. Your current policy of aggressive expansionism is putting you in a confrontation with the Arab world. You're better off propagating a Westphalian model where you respect borders, you respect non-interference, and so on and so forth. And I think it is very, very interesting how the three countries, and I speak here about Turkey, Iran, and Russia in Libya, have created a very unique model of confrontation and cooperation. But the main thing is today they have a lock on the Syrian issue, because they are really the ones who decide what happens. It's not the UN, it's not the rest of the Arab world. And I think from that perspective, the UAE's view is that we did make a huge mistake by kicking Syria out of the Arab League, because we burnt all our bridges. And currently, our influence on one of really the seminal crises of the Arab world of the 21st century, the Syrian tragedy, our influence is zero. And as a result, I think the UAE and many other Arab countries are propagating the idea that Turkey, Iran, you're our neighbors, but you have to respect the Arab world's sovereignty. You cannot see your political success at the expense of expanding your influence, expanding your ideology, expanding your economic interests in the Arab world, because this will backfire. And I think this this is backfiring, and I think this is also resulting really on weakening political Islam, which has really dominated the region for the last 30 years.
Now, looking from afar from Australia and looking at the region from here, there seems to be little coherence in the Trump administration's policy towards the Middle East. In fact, in terms of a number of policies, but the Middle East in particular, we've seen a Palestinian peace deal that didn't appear to include any Palestinian voices, with the announcement of a withdrawal of US force from Syria, and then there was a non-withdrawal and a partial withdrawal, but a unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA to be replaced by a policy of maximum pressure that doesn't appear to have really an achievable aim. Does the Trump administration's approach to the Middle East, raise questions in your mind about its coherence? And secondly, is there a broader feeling that Washington has lost interest in the region, or is a much weaker player these days than it ever has been in the past?
Again, I mean, this is a discussion that precedes really the Trump administration. It's a discussion about America's role in the world and America's role, as you mentioned, particularly in the Middle East. And there are two schools of thought. There's a school of thought that says that this is really cyclical within American, policy toward various regions in the world. So the idea that you will have, an American age of engagement, and then you have an American age of retrenchment. So that is one view. The other view really on this is that we're seeing something new. The Middle East is less important here. Certainly the Middle East is more complicated, but I can see from our perspective, I don't see an American withdrawal. I mean, I see an American engagement, but it is perhaps a much more careful engagement in the region. And as I said, this is not really a Trump era thing. It's something that precedes the Trump era. It's something that's post-Afghanistan, post-Iraq. Like somebody said, if you try and run away from the Middle East will run behind you and catch you. And I think the single important thing, unfortunately, is that most of the majority of the major crises today, life crises, are in the Middle East, unfortunately. And as a result, I think that many of these issues have an effect, a cascading effect on many countries. And I think also understanding, for example, terrorism, for example, has very much a Middle Eastern dimension because of Afghanistan and because of other developments that we have seen, because of ISIS, etc. So it's a cascading effect that will affect many, many Arab countries. My view is we're not going to see, and we're not seeing a withdrawal of interest, but we're seeing, I think, a change of interest. And I think from the UAE's perspective, this is important because, we look at America's involvement in the region as a positive involvement. We look at America as our major strategic ally. But I don't think it's also in our interest to get our major strategic ally embroiled in wars in the region. But I think that the overall, the 360 relationship that we have is the important part. And I think the approach on Iran is essentially correct. The approach on Iran is that Iran understood the JCPOA as a carte blanche, recognizing its dominant role in the region. And the JCPOA was not meant to do that. But Iran, definitely, if you compare Iran's engagement in the region and aggressiveness in the region post-JCPOA, it was much higher. And I think we, all of us, here in the UAE, we think we are beyond the JCPOA. but we are beyond the JCPOA. We can't really return back to the JCPOA. But what we really need is what we call JCPOA plus, plus plus quality. And here, what we're really talking about is addressing the three baskets of Iran's nefarious activity in the region, nuclear, missile, and regional. And I think we should, in our view, this has to be done politically. We need to de-escalate in the region. We need Iran to be engaged. And I think this is what's being offered right now. And we need a process to make sure that Iran also benefits from this, because Iran has to be also part of what we see at some point in the future as a region of stability and prosperity. You've got to give them the carrots, and I think this is important. But definitely, going back, this is a changing world, and this is a changing international system. And our choices, difficult choices sometimes, are made because we don't have the luxury of the past. We don't have the luxury of sitting back and waiting for somebody to maintain the stability of the region. And that is why you're seeing new players emerge in the region, such as Turkey, old players trying to create more influence, such as Iran, because they realize also that there are vacuums, and they realize that they can fill the vacuum. And our counter proposal is, yes, we want you to fill the vacuum, but we want you to be a part of the solution. We want you to be part of the stability and prosperity of the region. We don't want the region to be carved out, as you are doing right now, because this is not going to work and going to actually polarize further what we are seeing in the region.
Listen, we probably will finish this with this question before we take questions from the audience, but you really can't talk about the US without talking about China in the same breath these days. And certainly the rise of China has been one of the key debates in Australia over the last 6 to 12 months. And one of the major issues is a feeling that perhaps Australia and other liberal democracies have focused on economic relations with China, and it blinded us to the difference in values between those of liberal democracies and one-party states, and that the best way to ameliorate Chinese behaviour is to take a unified and a public stance when we believe that they've overstepped the line. And human rights tends to be one of these issues. Now, there seems to be a disparity between the way that liberal democracies view this and perhaps some people in the Arab world. And I use these two examples. In 2019, Australia and the other Western democracies criticised the actions by the Chinese government against the Muslim Uyghurs in a letter to the UN Human Rights Council. But the UAE and the other Gulf states signed a letter supporting the Chinese stance. And in June this year, Australia and Western liberal democracies criticised China's new national security law for Hong Kong in the council, but the UAE and other Gulf states supported China's position. This is a two-part question, I suppose. First of all, do you think there's a disparity in the way that the Gulf states view China and Chinese policies, and the way that Western liberal democracies view it, particularly in terms of human rights? And what do you believe that future holds for China and Chinese relations with countries in the region more broadly?
Well, again, China is emerging as a major player. In our region, China still is very much an economic and commercial player. But again, with China really becoming more of a technological powerhouse, I think that relationship is shifting. And I would also say that many, many countries, including us, will have quite a rough period ahead of us because of US-Chinese polarization. And here is because you have to really sort of navigate between your main strategic partner i.e. the United States, and your main commercial partner, i.e. China. And I think we're not alone in that position. So again, I think managing that up to now has been fine overall, but I think this will be a more difficult patch as we move forward. Now, having said that, I think, yes, I agree with you that foreign policy is very much reflective of what value system you put there. I think for us, the issue of non-interference is very important. The issue of resolving these issues privately, not publicly, is very important. I think that's reflective. But then again, this is not really a Gulf symptom. I mean, the OIC, which is, the main, organization with Muslim states, members, etc., there's a feeling that naming and shaming China is not the way forward. But at the same time, engaging with it over the Uyghur issue is more important. And I think this is the approach that the OIC and others have to a certain extent taken with other less important countries, such as Myanmar, for example. It hasn't always succeeded, but I think it is reflective also that you can't clone countries and make them all act and react the same way. Vis-a-vis that, I think what will be a very important element will be technology. Again, China is emerging. China 10 years ago was purely commercial and transactional partner for many countries in the region. But again, as you see Chinese technology becoming more at the forefront really of many things happening, I think many of these countries, including the UAE, will have these difficult issues of managing the polarization that we are seeing. And this is not only a Trump polarization. I think this is more within the American system. Maybe the nuance is different, but this, in my opinion, will be one of the issues that all countries will have to grapple. But we're not really seeing also the very actively the political side of China that you are seeing in your region. And, many of the China experts differ on what China seeks. Does China really want to be a major superpower along the lines of the United States or the old Soviet Union, which many argue it doesn't? But it does want to be a major player within its own cultural context. I think all these things are things that we are seeing. I'm not a China expert, but as I see it, I see a China that's becoming more and more important and powerful because also it is willing to give loans to many countries. It's willing to embark on various infrastructure programs in many third world countries, things that the Europeans, for example, don't do anymore. And I think here, the Chinese appetite will make also a difference as we see in many, many other areas. As far as we are concerned, they are our major commercial partner. I think our trade with them is one of the largest in the Middle East. And to be honest, we are cognizant of the more and more polarized situation vis-a-vis U.S.-China relations, and we realize that this will create a lot of difficult navigating moving forward.
I'm very conscious of the time, but I'll just take one of the questions we received from the audience. If we were to go through them all, we'd probably still be here tomorrow. But one of the questions was whether you think the Sultanate of Oman will change at all now that there's a new leader in the position and there are reports, for instance, that a multi-billion-dollar development contract with an Emirati company, Damac, has been cancelled recently. But I just ask for your general observations about whether a new ruler of Oman, who's obviously going to have to take time to put his feet under the table, do you think we'll see the same kind of stable centrist policies in the region and internationally that Oman has been famous for up until now?
Well, definitely, yes. I mean, it will be continuity and change. I mean, Oman is, an established country with the ruling family there since the early 18th century. So it will be continuity. And change, of course, is you will always have a new sultan put a certain imprint after 40 years of rule by the legendary Sultan Qaboos. We in the UAE, Oman is our most important partner along with Saudi Arabia. And because we have what I call a live border with Oman. We have basically villages that are half in Oman and half in the UAE. We have families that are linked. We have a live border there. And I think for us, we have a vested interest in a prosperous and stable Oman, as they do in ours at the same time. The Damac deal, I think, is a private deal. I mean, private deals work and don't work. There are a multitude of UAE investments in Oman and Omani investments in the UAE. Many are prospering very well and doing very well. And you will get also some that have overextended, overreached, or, the economic climate was not right or whatever. That, I would say, is normal, and I wouldn't put any political emphasis there.
Listen, Dr. Gargash, we could be here for a lot longer than this, but we promised you about 45 minutes out of your very busy schedule, and you've been generous enough to give us that, so we'll also honour our agreement. So thank you very much, Dr. Gargash, for what we've done today, not only the time, but your insights that you've given us. Relations between the UAE and Australia are strong, and they've grown stronger over the last 15 years, and I'm sure that that trend will continue into the future. I'd also like to thank everybody else for joining us at this latest Lowy Institute live event. Now, our next live stream event will be announced on our website shortly, so make sure that you keep an eye out for it. But in the meantime, I'd just like to again express our thanks to you, Dr. Gargash, from myself personally and the Institute generally for joining us. And I hope that you and your family stay safe and well in the future.